This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Ray Bjorklund. Ray is the Chief Knowledge Officer for Dell Tech, and Cameron Luthy. Cameron is the Senior Budget Analyst, for Bloomberg Government. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Well, hey, guys, it's day four of sequestration, and you guys are here to talk about, you know, the budget, sequestration, implications for government industry. You know, and also it's just sort of the big picture. So I guess the first thing is, you know, I kept thinking, you know, on March 1st, I kept thinking about sequestration in terms of, you know, Lost in Space and Danger, Will Robinson, danger, you know, so the robot there. So see, I told you, people would, you know, now people know really how old I am. But first, I think we'll just talk about the snapshot today on day four. Where are we? What's going on? And I'll start with Ray.
All right. Well, unlike what was supposed to happen early in January, we're not falling off any kind of fiscal cliff right now. It's not quite as disastrous as everybody had been hyping it, both from Congress and the White House. And of course, the news media had also been hyping this. We're going to get through this. We are going to be cutting back on spending, and it will be affecting people, especially here in the Washington area. But it is a serious thing that we have to deal with.
Cameron?
I think you have to differentiate between sort of the aggregate or macroeconomic impact, which is relatively modest when you're talking about $85 billion being taken away from federal agencies' checking accounts. And knowing that actually, if they had it, they wouldn't spend it all this year anyway, about $42 billion, according to CBO's estimates. But you have to differentiate between that sort of macroeconomic perspective, the big picture, and the tactical. If you're an individual who receives federal benefits in the form of grants or what have you, or if you're a federal worker who's going to be furloughed for 20 days, or if you're a federal contractor where the government's going to come in and make changes, then you're talking about some real pain.
Right. So it really is all about where you sit and how it's going to impact you. So I'm curious now, can you explain why only $42 billion or so is really going to be cut in that, you know, that other 43 approximately, I guess that's right. Did I do my math right there? So I'm not the budget guy. So so you have to tell me how to get the math right. Why isn't it... You know, why wasn't it going to be spent this year? That's kind of interesting.
Think about it from the standpoint of the government as a buyer, right? They get money. They don't spend it all up front. And some of the money they have more than 1 year to spend. So if they're going to buy goods and services from a contractor, they're not going to give them all the money up front. They're going to make progress payments throughout the life of the contract. If they hire a federal worker, they're only going to pay them every 2 weeks, not all the money up
front.
And in the case of DOD in particular, they have money sometimes where they have 2, 3, and up to 5 years before they have to put it on a contract.
Okay, so it's sort of back end.
The lag effect.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and even thinking on how the government's going to be able to execute on the dollars that are appropriated now, and there's always lag time in procurement operations, particularly with the acquisition workforce being what it is.
Yeah, so, and I guess, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you guys is to sort of give a perspective, a quick sort of snapshot of how we got to where we are, so to speak. I mean, I know that may be right word for that, you know, drama is, but, you know, how did we end up with March 1st actually having sequestration?
Well, one thing that's kind of curious is people around the country are trying to come to grips with this word called sequestration. It's a tool that's been available for a few decades now, and it has occasionally been used in the past. How we got to the point of applying a sequester now is that the Budget Control Act of 2011 had demanded that there would be some radical change, rebalancing of the way the government spends, the way the government takes in revenue. And they, at that time, in conjunction with that act, formed the so-called super committee, and the super committee failed to do what it was tasked to do. And consequently, that put certain caps in position for mandatory spending and caps for discretionary spending and caps for defense and caps for non-defense that the White House and the administration, the executive branch, had to stay within. And once they exceed those caps, then that top amount of money that would exceed the caps that were set in law would be sequestered. And it's a presidential decision to sequester, and that's what's now been done.
If I can add to that, there's a special wrinkle.
Okay. I'm waiting for the wrinkle.
The wrinkle is...
I like that pause. That's a good dramatic effect there, Cameron.
As Ray correctly pointed out, we've had this this sequester phenomenon in our budget geekery for a long time. But what's extra special, what the wrinkle is, this sequester for 2013 isn't like any other sequester we've ever had before. It's, some people call it the punishment sequester because the super committee failed. It doesn't matter that whether spending's under the caps or above the caps, it gets applied just the same.
Really?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Nasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you could be saving money, but you have to save even more money, right?
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
That's
right.
Okay. Exactly.
I mean, you know, give the administration some credit. Over the last couple of years, they have taken steps to cut spending, and spending has been going down, at least the stuff that we care about a lot, which is contractor addressable spending, has been going down as the government's been trying to get control of the deficit. They just didn't get there fast enough, and now the sequester must be enacted.
Okay, yeah, and with regard to that, you know, just how does it, you know, how does it sort of play out over a little bit, just big picture wise, over the rest of the year? I mean, you know, one of the thing, I know we're going to talk in the next segment about a lot about government operations, but just sort of big picture, the thing that I was sort of is fascinating to me is that, you know, it was supposed to kick in, what, January 1st, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that gave 9 months over the remaining of the fiscal year to make, you know, adjustments. And then they kicked the can down the road to March 1st. So you got even less time to try to figure it out. Now, do you think, have they been trying to figure it out all this time? Or are they going to figure it out now? And it seems like they have even greater pressure to try to, you know, figure out where to reduce spending because they have less time to do it.
I think behind the scenes, the White House and the major departments and agencies have been trying to figure out how to accommodate a potential sequester. Administration didn't want to publicly admit it because, in a way, that was like saying we're planning for defeat, planning for the lack of a decision. But I think behind the scenes, despite the pronouncements from some of the most senior people in the administration, it has been under consideration. And, you know, recognize that even today we're still under a continuing resolution, which is already putting a certain degree of a cap on spending, even though this CR or continuing resolution is actually gives just a little bit more money than it typically does.
Okay. Cameron?
The one way to look at it is if you're a prudent program manager in the federal government, would you want to drive at the speed limit, so to speak, from a budgetary standpoint and hope that everything turns out okay? Or would you throttle it back a little bit when it comes to spending? Okay. So depending on the program manager you talk to, some have been more cautious preparing for this event than others. All have been quiet about it, exactly as Ray has correctly identified. And I think if you talk to a contractor, any contractor in Washington, who does business with the federal government, they'll give you a cross-section, kind of a, some of them are being more cautious, some of them are willing to talk to me, some of them are not, some of them...
Some of the government folks, right?
The program managers,
contracting officers,
Some of them are being ostriches and sticking their head in the sand and pretending that it'll never happen, you know, so I think it depends.
Well, yeah, and I guess it is kind of a big gamble if you decide that it's... that somehow, some way I'm going to be made whole. So I'm going to drive the speed limit, to, you know, to use your example or metaphor there, Cameron. And it gets to the end of the year, there might be a brick wall right in front of that, you know, where you're driving,
and,
right?
And certainly you could say that the visibility has been limited.
Yeah,
so. Nobody's got a crystal ball here.
Right, yeah. That's true. So
a lot of fog on the road.
That's right. I was looking for that. You got it for me. Thank you, Kia. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it. So, but right now we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Cameron Luthy. Cameron is a senior budget analyst for Bloomberg Government, and Ray Bjorklund, Chief Knowledge Officer for Dell Tech, and we'll talk about government operations and what the impact is. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Cameron Luthy. Cameron is a senior budget analyst for Bloomberg Government, and Ray Bjorklund. Ray is chief knowledge officer for Dell Tech. And yeah, I got them both in the room to talk budget numbers and what's going on with sequestration here in day four in Washington, D.C. And Cameron, I'll start with you. You know, this segment, I want to sort of try to focus on, you know, the impact, you know, on agencies. What does it really mean for the government? Where are things going? You know, what the mechanics of it are? And if I'm a program manager, we started a little bit last segment. If I'm a program manager, what am I looking at? Or if I'm just the head of an agency, where do I go? What do I do in terms of trying to manage through this process? So, you know, just your thoughts.
Well, let's sort of break the universe into two parts, the defense and everybody else.
That's the way it always works around here, right? They're out of town, right?
Yeah, it's not fair. Okay. I worked one company where they said, don't say non-defense, say civilian agencies.
Okay.
We want to give them respect, too.
All right, that's right.
So, and it's particularly weird with when you're talking budget stuff like this, because OMB and the budget geeks around town have something called the government functions or budget functions. And when they talk about defense, a lot of times they're not just talking about the Department of Defense. They're talking about the defense function, which includes the weapons programs at DOE and some odds and ends scattered about throughout the rest of the government.
Yeah, but DOD does a lot of the nuclear stuff, right?
Yeah, you got it. But when you're talking about the defense function writ large, it's a 7.8% reduction for discretionary spending on the defense side.
Okay.
All right. On the civilian agency side, for civilian functions, 5%.
Okay.
For discretionary programs again. So if there's nothing special in the law that says your particular program is exempt.
Okay.
Then those are the numbers you're facing. Now, the biggest exemption from those reductions that we all know about is the Veterans Administration.
Right. Right. They're completely exempt, right?
They're held harmless.
Right.
The whole agency.
Right.
There's a couple of accounts that are still subject to sequestration.
Right. And aren't military personnel, are they?
That's exempt? Another big exception. Yeah. Right. So that's partly why the numbers come out the way they do, because the size of the cut.
Right.
Doesn't change. So it's what base is it being applied to? And
okay.
That base has been modified by adding funds for Hurricane Sandy. It actually made the base bigger, which helped make the percentage cuts smaller.
Okay.
I know. Math.
Man, you guys are hurting my head right now. So. Already, and it's only, we just started segment two, and I need some aspirin. So what does that, you know, so put that, can you put that in plain language for me, right?
Well, it's one thing to talk about the overall percentages associated with defense and non-defense, but as Cameron was noting, there are many accounts. There's about three dozen accounts of the 3,300 or so that the Treasury manages on behalf of the government, about three dozen of them that are exempt. And when you have that one big account, which is military personnel that the president could make a choice on, and the president did choose to exempt military personnel, you make those exemptions, that provides a whole lot of pressure on the other accounts. And while on an account-by-account basis, it's supposed to be a certain percentage for each account, and as Cameron noted, you know, it's rolled up into one number for defense and non-defense. But it creates a certain amount of pressure and dynamic. And we were talking about in the last segment about driving, you know, a speed limit and going through a fog. Well, and Cameron noted a brick wall. There's something called the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Okay. Yes, I've heard of that.
Yes.
When I was in government.
Yes. And when you hit that brick wall, you are in trouble. Your program's in trouble. Your mission's in trouble.
You as an individual can be in trouble.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
No, nobody's gone to jail yet, but there have been some early retirements.
Yeah,
yes. Yes.
Or reassignments, right?
Right. So as Cameron's noted earlier, the program managers have to be very cautious and anticipate what their funding needs are going to be. And there isn't much wiggle room. There's a little bit of wiggle room within these accounts. And I think that the defense, because of its 75 or so accounts, they're pretty big. Each one of them is pretty big. So they've got a little bit of wiggle room. So if there's a very important training mission that needs to occur because maybe it's an international exercise, that would probably go on. But the rest of the O&M budget would take a larger hit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah. So, can you put that? How is it? Program, projecting activity. Is that the right language I'm using in terms of how they apply the cuts? So, what does that mean for like the Army? Would it be their own O&M account? Would they just have a bigger pool? Is that what you're saying? Can you?
Yeah. If you think about DoD, and then we'll jump to the civilian side.
Sure.
So, on the defense side, program, project, and activity is pretty well defined when it comes to procurement programs and R&D.
Okay.
Very detailed. So if it's applied across the board as the law states, then it doesn't matter. For example, you've got a budget account, which is, say, for example, procurement of aircraft for the Air Force.
Sure.
Right? Within that, you've got a line item that would be at the program level, say, purchasing Joint Strike Fighter.
Okay.
All right? And then with below that level would be the components for that aircraft, the avionics, the radar, mm-hmm. the weapon systems, and so on. Now you're talking.
But they're not buying a second engine, so that's okay.
Right. That makes it easier. Whereas on the O&M side, as right. Ray pointed out, there's the sense that it would be the budget account that would be the unit of aggregation to which sequestration would be applied. So O&M Air Force includes everything from training, as Ray pointed out, to paying civilian workers, to buying paper clips and staples.
Okay, so in that case, the Air Force would have a lot more flexibility in the O&M account to figure out where to prioritize their funding. But for the other example with, you know, a specific project or account that goes down to like the Joint Strike Fighter, then they've got to look and sort of almost do an objective across the board for each of those, you know, components.
They don't have the flexibility on that side of the ledger, as it were. Compare that to the civilian agencies, and it depends. Some civilian agencies have really fuzzy definitions of what a program, project, and activity is. Some have more specific.
It's true. Yeah, Department of Homeland Security is well known for the depth of its budget. Its congressional justification documents, a PDF file, it's about 32 megabytes. It's rich in quality and quantity, and it does get right down to the PPAs.
Okay.
And, you know, there is an important defense mission there. It's not only just general national defense, but like the Coast Guard. And so you start getting in line items of the Coast Guard, just like Cameron was explaining, you can get into line items for procurement dollars in the Department of Defense and for RDT&E and so on.
So if I'm DHS, I'm kind of like, I already have my roadmap, right? I have what I have to do.
Well, or maybe you have your hands tied.
Yeah.
And that's what's unfortunate. If you do, if you don't have the wiggle room, like some of the agencies, like say a Department of Labor, you've got a lot more flexibility because you haven't defined things in a public way down to the PPA level.
Right. To your point, they've lost the discretion to be able to manage this process, and they've got to go by the formula or the documents that have already been created.
Right? Yes, yes.
Right. Okay, so, but the flip side, there's other, you mentioned an example of agencies where it's a bit more fuzzy?
Yeah, I mean, Department of Labor is fuzzy. Even to some degree, USDA is many complex programs that they have. It is a lot more fuzzy. In the example of Commerce has some, and I'm not saying this in a denigrating way, calling them fuzzy programs, but Commerce has fuzzy programs, but they also have NOAA, which has some very explicit program line items that need to be managed according to these sequester rules.
Okay. So, how would an agency, and I don't know if you guys have thought about it, like agency like GSA, that's sort of a combination of reimbursable funding plus appropriations. Are they just going to be impacted because there may be less business being done by their customers or what?
Yeah,
Cameron?
Yeah, I think Ray can help me here, but I think that in general, most of GSA, now we're talking about the supply side, not the federal building side, but even there, most of the money that they're getting, whether it's GSA rent or GSA supply schedules, it's from the customer. So it's a secondary effect. If the customer's got less money, there's going to be less money going through GSA.
Okay, great. And, you know, and to that point, I guess that's also an opportunity for GSA if there's, as a shared services model there, where they, in terms of providing more support, if agencies make decisions that, it's more efficient for me to use something that's pre-existing than going and doing, a new contract vehicle.
Well, and even assisted acquisition. I mean, you can think of that as a, whether or not, people would agree it's really working real well or not, but assisted acquisition, that sort of centralized service could be a great boon for the agencies who are going to have to furlough people.
Sure, sure. But right now, guys, we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Ray Bjorklund. Ray is the Chief Knowledge Officer for Dell Tech, and Cameron Luthy. Cameron is Senior Budget Analyst for Bloomberg Government, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Ray Bjorklund. Ray is Chief Knowledge Officer at Dell Tech, and Cameron Luthy. Cameron is Senior Budget Analyst for Bloomberg Government. Guys, when we took the break, we've been talking government operations a little bit. And I guess I just want to get your thoughts a little bit about one of the things that we keep hearing about is furloughs of employees. Is that something really on the table? I mean, you hear all kinds of different stories, and I don't want to say any of them are urban myths, and some are true. I don't know what it is, so I'd like to hear from the budget analyst perspective what it all means.
Well, there certainly is a little bit of political hype associated with what this impact could mean. Whether you're going to close national parks because you don't have rangers, whether you're going to have longer lines in TSA, which I understand that Janet Napolitano has given people warning about longer lines, or if you're doing some critical thing like counterterrorism. Yes, furloughs are a very real way of saving money, avoiding payment. Now, there's some people are saying that once the sequester issues are finally resolved, and once we get past the end date for a continuing resolution, get something set for the rest of the year, people will probably get back pay for the period that they were furloughed, because that has been practiced in the past. But that doesn't help people right now that are, in some cases, living paycheck to paycheck. And it's very, very unfortunate that civil servants who have already been through a couple of years of pay freeze are now having to give up additional income.
Sure. Cameron, any thoughts on it?
Yeah. One of the things that we're starting to piece together from the announcement on Friday and other sources is we expect that the typical federal agency's response will be to furlough people for no more than around 20 days, because that keeps them out of the rules that apply to a reduction in force.
Okay, yeah.
Which would, depending on how long somebody had been a federal employee, might cost the government a fair amount.
Sure.
So that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second thing is it seems as though the Department of Defense, based on what some of my colleagues have done in the math, and they're even geekier about math than I am, Roger.
Man, I don't know what to make of that, Cameron. I need to go over to Bloomberg Government and see what the heck's going on over there.
they seem to think that there's something in the water.
Right.
if you look at rotating every, people taking turns, taking a day off a week or spreading it out over time, it's still going to put an enormous pressure on contracts at DOD. And what that means, I think we'll get into a little bit more. But in a sense, if you're talking about federal agencies, right, they pay people and they buy things. They buy services and goods, but they buy stuff.
Right. To perform their missions. So. And I have to think back to the mid-90s when they had the government shut down. I mean, I just recall everybody ended up getting paid in the end, right? And it's almost like, it was true that in some instances it would have cost more not to pay people than to actually just process the normal paychecks or something, make the adjustments, and they just took care of it.
But it's no certainty. It's no certainty that people are going to get paid.
Right. I agree. And it is significant concern, especially when you think about all those folks who do, are in public service and do work on all our behalfs. Thinking about this and just, where you go from here, and I guess one of the things that we do want to talk about, or we definitely want to talk about, is what does it mean for, government contractors as well? And Cameron, you started that by saying, hey, look, there's definitely going to be impact on DOD. Can you guys talk about what and it's only day four, so I don't think we're seeing it. We may start seeing it soon, but what's going to happen? Well, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, in the first segment,
and I will hold you to it.
No. Okay. In the first segment, we were hinting that program managers that are prudent have been considering this and slowing down and looking at different scenarios for how they might pay their contractors. There's one general piece of, conventional wisdom that if you are already on contract, if the government has already obligated dollars to your contract, that you are now liquidating in the performance of that contract, even if it's going to be going all the way through the rest of this fiscal year and into next fiscal year, you're probably good to go. But if an agency is in a position where they critically need certain amount of funding, they might have to raid those contracts. They probably won't terminate the contract, which would be a natural termination by no longer funding it, but they may reduce the scope of effort associated with that contract. They may tell the contractor, scale back, charge less, and those kinds of things to try and mitigate the risks that the government might be faced on coming up against the Anti-Deficiency Act violation.
Cameron, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think Ray's comments sort of draw up a distinction, too. When the government's buying a major investment, whether it's a new IT system or a new weapon system or whatever, it's a multi-year effort. And depending on the nature of the contract, it might be harder to modify that contract because it may end up increasing your unit cost or your total cost for the period of the contract.
Sure, isn't that like, you know, when they cut back the number of, you know, fighters they're going to buy, you know, the cost actually goes up mm-hmm. per copy.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
You don't get the economies of scale kind of thing.
Exactly. So what that does in turn is it puts more pressure on professional services contracting, where you've hired a consulting firm to help you with business process reengineering to make the government more efficient, or you've hired a professional services contractor to provide staff augmentation for an analytical cell or to do data analytics, for example. So there, as Ray correctly pointed out, the modification to the contract would be the path most likely to be followed rather than killing the contract outright. So change the level of effort, do a modification. Fewer staff would be assigned to that contract on the part of the contractor. So you can see the ripple effect through the economy.
Right. But what you're doing now, right, I think your point is you're saving money in the short run, but you actually may end up having to spend more money in the long run, right? To compensate if you're not buying as many copies of something, or you don't get that study done, you know, as comprehensively as you want to do it on how to make a more efficient operation. I mean, it's hard to quantify that, but there's costs and investments there that will be impacted. Have you guys seen a delay in, you know, procurements going out the door as well? Is that something that's been, you know, so we have definitely, I've definitely seen that. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I hadn't been able to quantify it yet, but yes, we're definitely seeing that where contractors or say companies interested in pursuing certain work have been anticipating the award of a task order or anticipating a new contract. And you start to see the announcements in FedBiz Ops where the procuring agency is saying, well, we're going to rethink this just a little bit, or, oh, there's a little too much uncertainty. That's what they're communicating. And so they're slowing down that procurement process.
Right. I think at DOD, it's almost like if it's not mission critical, right, they're holding off and waiting to see. Now they've got to, you know, this is before, but
yes.
Now they've got to
yes.
execute and figure out and make decisions. On what's going for the things where they can make decisions, they've got to think about that. Do you have any other thoughts on that, Cameron?
Well, there's so many different ways that can manifest itself. For example, you can have a delay in the RFP coming out. You can have a delay in the award being made. You can have an extension of the current contract for another 6 months because they're not sure they're going to have the funding to do the new vehicle.
And you know what, Cameron? I can't extend this segment anymore because we have a couple coming up on the hard break. But when we come back, we'll talk more about what it means for government procurement and contracting and also, you know, the mission of various agencies. My guests today are Ray Bjorklund, Chief Knowledge Officer at Deltek, and Cameron Luthi, Senior Budget Analyst for Bloomberg Government, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Cameron Luthi. Cameron is Senior Budget Analyst for Bloomberg Government, and Ray Bjorklund. Ray is Chief Knowledge Officer for Deltek. And guys, when we took the break, we were talking about, you know, procurement in terms of delays potentially in procurements, changes in scope, you know, maybe cutting back on quantities and that kind of thing. You know, one thing I'm curious to get your thoughts on, too, is what does it mean for, you know, pre-existing contracts, in particular, like your government-wide contracts? Do you anticipate or have you seen more use of those as a result? I mean, I think, you know, and I know Ray will chime in on this one, but I think, you know, like, for example, the GSA schedules, you know, they're not shrinking, they're not really growing, but what that means is they're actually becoming a larger percentage of the federal spend because the federal spend is going down. So that's my budget numbers for the day, guys. I'm trying to feel like I'm one of you guys. So Ray, your thoughts?
I've heard anecdotes saying that there is increasing use of multiple award and multi-agency contracts and the schedules, which are, in a sense, multiple award also. You know, but it is kind of hard to measure. I agree with you that since the GSA schedule sales are kind of flat and overall spending, contract spending by the government is down, so the GSA schedule sales are showing a little bit higher proportion of that. where I think this all comes down to is that the federal agencies are looking for the easiest way to get something on contract. Schedules are certainly a tool for doing that. And some of those anecdotes that I've heard are increasingly in the even the aerospace and defense community. There's a desire to use schedules to be expeditious in the procurement operations. The same with multiple award IDIQs, all the way from GWACs to just a multi-agency contract. There's contracting officers around the government are not in a large enough population, not big enough numbers. There's a lot of things in their inbox. They are looking for relatively easy ways to get their needs on contract. And so there has been this general, over the last several years, increase in the use of IDIQ types of contracts, including schedules.
Right. Cameron, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's the same pattern that our analysts at Bloomberg have noticed, this shift to the multiple award vehicle. Though there's a sort of a corollary that goes along with that, which is that there are too many of them out there. And OFPP has got a plan for trying to rationalize the number of redundant multiple award contracts. And
good luck on that.
Yeah, I know. That's the theory.
Well, to your Ray's point and your point, Cameron, there are too many of them, and good luck. But I think, I'm maybe the, eternal optimist, but I do think if there was a time where people were going to address contract duplication, now is the time to do that. It increases mm-hmm. costs for industry. It increases yes. costs for the government, unnecessarily sure. so. And if there's a way to, as you say, Cameron, rationalize the contracts to the point where it makes good business sense for the private sector and for government to meet mission requirements, I think, I do think there's an opportunity right now given the budget constraints, but we'll see how that plays out. So Cameron, now I just want to sort of turn a little bit more to the bigger picture. I guess that foggy road that we were talking about earlier with Ray's example there. We've got some events coming up in terms of, I guess, what is a no budget, no pay kind of situation there for the Senate and the House in terms of passing a budget. It's soon, I think, right? And then also we've got the debt ceiling coming up and, we're operating on a continuing resolution. So like in sort of the more immediate this year, fiscal year, what's to come?
So if you're looking down that foggy road, you've got some interesting events coming up, as you said, starting maybe as early as the 11th of March, the House Republicans Budget Committee, that's Mr. Ryan, Chairman Ryan.
Yes.
Is going to be putting together his budget blueprint. And bear in mind, budget resolutions don't have force of law. They're just a roadmap, right?
Sure, yep.
Senate's going to do likewise. They're going to lay out sort of big picture, how much spending in total, how much discretionary, how much mandatory, how much revenues, and how do we get there from here? Then you've got the March 27th deadline for the expiration of the current continuing resolution, which provides funding through that date, and Congress has to do something about that. And you heard the president talk last week about, I think we should do something to provide full year funding and leave sequester out of it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And there's the House Appropriations Committee today put out their press release, and they're putting their bill together to get us moving forward on that score. So there's a bunch of things coming up here. When it comes to the debt ceiling, that's sort of down the road a little bit, May, June timeframe. It's May 18th, I believe, is when the current suspension of the debt ceiling expires and Congress needs to do something about that and send it to the president. We're not sure, but if you ask me to guess, I'd say that doesn't become the sort of Donnybrook that led us to this path in the first place in August of 2011, because I think having blinked once, I think the Republicans are not likely to drive yeah. this car right up to the brick wall.
Right. And I think I heard something yesterday about, they're going to probably speculation purely, but they'll probably agree to something extended to the end of the fiscal year or something. Okay, I heard something on this very radio station on my way to work. This one, so, Ray, do you have any thoughts?
It's curious to me. Now, I know Congress has a timeline that they are supposed to adhere to for the appropriation cycle. But that usually is once they have received the president's budget, which we don't know what that is yet because the president has not submitted his budget. And so it's kind of intriguing to think about the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee coming up with their game plans and their 602B allocations or 302B allocations, for the strategy when they don't even know what the administration's going to ask for. So I kind of scratch my head on that. I mean, it's going to be a very messy several months, very messy several months.
And how do you, what's sort of the end game here? What, when you look at the budget, where it's going, what's already been transpired in terms of, we're basically live under a continuing resolution, don't we?
It's the norm.
It's the new normal, right? Yeah. And we've been that way, and now we've had sequestration hit. We did have an agreement on a tax increase back, to sort of extend and the sequestration and try to deal with it. The Budget Commission failed. What's the time frame here to try? I mean, at some point they're going to work something out. I would have to believe.
Yes.
But what do you think? When's the realistic timeline for doing something like that?
One window of opportunity is the continuing resolution, but I'm not sure enough time will go by where enough people outside the Beltway say, hey, you guys need to figure this out and do something about sequestration between now and then. It may have to wait till later. When it comes to 14, Ray raised a really important point. We still haven't seen the president's budget yet, so that makes things really complicated for the budget resolution, at least on the Senate side, where in theory they'd want it to sort of match up with
what
the Democrats
they're trying to do, absolutely,
in the White House and the Democrats in the Senate. But Ray's right. This is going to be a messy, bumpy ride.
Yeah, for several months. And I think even by the end of the fiscal year, although we'll be up against some other minor crises, by the end of the fiscal year in September, I think things will settle out. Because they got recess planned between now and then a couple times.
Right. They got to go home, right? And find out what the impact of sequestration, right? So we got about a minute left. And I just want to ask you guys to sort of, each of you take about 30 seconds to sort of sum up, what this sort of sequestration means, for me, I guess the government and industry as well, who's supporting government missions. Just this year, what it's going to mean.
I think it's, we all have to take heart. We're going to get through this. Everybody's going to get through this. It's going to be painful, a little painful for contractors, certainly because they'll be marking time more often than not because of delayed and slowed down procurements. And for the government civilians, I feel sorry again for them that they're be going through furloughs.
Absolutely.
But, we're going to get through this.
I think the real question for industry is less about 13, because I think Ray's correct. I think really it's longer term plans about merger, acquisition, divestiture,
sure,
strategic hires, and all of that, because right now there's no grand bargain in sight for what to do about 14, 15, 16, 17, and beyond, where under current law, spending will be less.
Yes, absolutely.
That's
so,
right.
And so, guys, I want to thank you for being on the show. It was great. I want to thank my guest today, Cameron Luthi. He's Senior Budget Analyst for Bloomberg Government, and Ray Bjorklund, Chief Knowledge Officer for Deltek. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.